All right, to backtrack just a bit, keep in mind around 12 o'clock, 12:30 that day, Confederate forces were falling back in this direction in great disorder, having suffered some rather severe losses over on Matthews Hill that morning. The Union Army at the same time thought they had the situation well in hand. What the Union Army was unaware of was the fact there were a lot more Confederates here in Manassas than they had previously anticipated with the arrival of General Johnston's army from the Shenandoah Valley. In fact, at that very hour, another fresh brigade from the Army of the Shenandoah was just arriving in this immediate vicinity. This was the 1st Virginia Brigade under the immediate command of newly appointed Brigadier General Thomas J. Jackson. Now, Jackson was a very able and experienced officer. He had graduated 17th in his class at West Point back in 1846. He had served with distinction as an artillery officer in the Mexican War. And for about 10 years prior to the war, Jackson had been a professor at the Virginia Military Institute. When Jackson arrived here at the head of his column, he quickly sized up the situation and decided the next best place to meet the enemy was here on the Henry Farm. Jackson had a pretty good eye for terrain and found an ideal position to deploy his 5 regiments of infantry and several batteries of artillery. Now, while Jackson was forming his line of battle, Brigadier General Barnard B. of South Carolina came riding up. General B. essentially reported that his command had been beaten back that morning. Jackson responded, saying something to the effect that he would meet the enemy here and give them the bayonet. Whereupon General B. rode off toward the Robinson Farm to try to find what was left of his scattered command. Later that afternoon, General B. found the remnants of the 4th Alabama Volunteers. These troops had seen some of the heaviest fighting that morning. Their colonel was among those mortally wounded. So General B. took it upon himself to rally these troops and lead them back into the fighting. In doing so, he drew his sword, pointed towards Jackson's position, shouting out, "Look, there stands Jackson like a stone wall. Let us rally on the Virginians." Now, as you can see, General B.'s words are carved in stone here on this monument, but to be truthful and honest, we have to confess these might not be General B.'s exact words. There are several different versions to the story. Unfortunately, General B. never had an opportunity to clarify his remarks that day. He was also among the casualties, being mortally wounded right about where you see this white stone monument over here. Nevertheless, within a week after the battle, stories were circulating through all the southern papers of how Jackson and his brigade had stood like a stone wall and had saved the day for the Confederacy here at Manassas. The name Stonewall certainly had a ring to it, and it would follow Jackson and his brigade around for the rest of their careers. And much of the praise was richly deserved. Jackson certainly gave the Union Army a very rude surprise up here on top of this hill. But to understand how Jackson was able to achieve the element of surprise, you need to understand how Jackson took advantage of the terrain out here. For the remainder of this tour, I encourage you to ignore this monument here behind me. This monument can be somewhat misleading, especially to those who don't come out here and take my tour. A lot of people are tempted to take their pictures of Jackson and go home thinking that Jackson actually stood right out here on top of this hill in the middle of this field, where, needless to say, he could be seen for miles around. Indeed, even with the tall grass and scattered pines and cedars, had Jackson lined up his brigade in this immediate vicinity, they would have been rather conspicuous. But I can assure you that no Union battery commander in his right mind would put his guns within musket range of a line of enemy infantry. Certainly Captain Ricketts and Captain Griffin had their reservations about advancing here to Henry Hill, but that was largely due to their lack of confidence in their own infantry supports. These artillerymen really had no way of knowing at the time that there were some 2,500 fresh Confederate troops ready and waiting for them up here. Jackson had placed these troops in a position which made them virtually invisible. It's a position you really can't appreciate until you're almost right on top of it. But before we take a closer look at Jackson's actual position, I think there is one other misleading aspect about this monument that should be addressed, and that is the fact that Jackson really did not look very much like this. The sculptor took a few liberties here. When the state of Virginia erected this monument in 1940, of course, Jackson's legend was larger than life. But in reality, Jackson was not a very commanding figure. He did not stand out in a crowd. He looked somewhat awkward on horseback, according to some of his contemporaries. That's not to say that he was not a good equestrian. It's just that his figure is somewhat ungainly on horseback, that's all. Jackson oftentimes could not really be distinguished that well from among some of the enlisted men in his brigade, simply because Jackson oftentimes was wearing a rather shabby uniform, his old forage cap pulled down over his eyes. He did not wear his rank very conspicuously. He stood close to 6 foot in height. He had rather large feet, according to most of the sources I've read, but still, he was not that robust an individual. Certainly, he had some very peculiar habits with regard to his health. Certainly, we have no documentation which would indicate he and his horse were taking steroids, as this monument might imply. Nor was Jackson wearing this type of uniform that day. Most of our sources tend to agree that Jackson was wearing his old Mexican War uniform, his old U.S. Army blue uniform. And Jackson was not alone. He was among a few that were former U.S. Army officers, and many of them were still wearing their old U.S. Army uniforms. So it was very difficult, really, to tell a Union officer from a Confederate officer at any distance. And it was equally difficult to tell Union troops from Confederate troops. There were just as many Union regiments running around in gray militia uniforms as there were Confederates wearing militia gray. You had just about every combination of blue and gray and every shade of blue and gray among the various militia units out here that day, both north and south. You had some very colorful Zouave units as well. I've already mentioned the fire Zouaves, but there were also units on the southern side dressed in very similar garb. There was in particular a battalion from Louisiana that was dressed remarkably similar. On the Confederate side in particular, there were also a number of troops that had been mustered into their regiments just a week earlier, and even though they'd been issued weapons, they had not yet been issued uniforms. So they were still running around out here in their civilian clothes. Consequently, you really couldn't tell who was who at any distance out here, especially through all the smoke. And again, I'll remind you, it was a very oppressive July day, not much breeze in the heat and humidity. And consequently, under those conditions, the smoke from the musketry and artillery fire just lingered on the field. You could not see from one side of this field to the other. There were times you couldn't even see 100 yards in front of you, and then you were faced with the dilemma of deciding who those people were out there in front of you 100 yards away with guns. About the only way you might be able to identify the troops in front of you would be by the colors they carried, their flags. The problem here was the first Confederate national flag was red, white, and blue, all in the same places as the U.S. flag. Now, to be sure, the Confederate Stars and Bars, as it was called, had fewer stars and fewer stripes. But considering the fact there wasn't much of a breeze that day, and with all the smoke on the field, it was virtually impossible to tell the difference between the two. When Jeb Stuart came out of the woods down here along the Sedley Road, he saw all these troops in front of him with red shirts. He initially thought they were the battalion from New Orleans. He called out to them, yelling, "Don't worry, boys, I'm here now." And then all of a sudden, a little wisp of wind unfurled the U.S. flag, and he realized his mistake. Instead, he immediately ordered his troops to charge, causing all kinds of havoc down there behind the Union lines. General Beauregard was confused at the height of the fighting that afternoon by the similarities in the flags. It proved to be very confusing. There was perhaps one other way to identify the troops in front of you. That would be the state flags carried by the various militia units. Okay, how many people here know what all the other state flags look like? I'm sure then you'll understand why it was so easy to be shot in the back by friendly forces that day, as you could get shot by the enemy. And there are quite a few documented cases of troops receiving friendly fire out here. It was a very traumatic and terrifying experience for most of those involved. To one eyewitness, it looked like a battle between two armed mobs. But the key to understanding what actually happened out here resides in the position where Jackson initially deployed his troops. And you get a much better feel for that over on the other side of the field here. Now, we're going to head off toward these oak trees over here. I've kept you out in the sun long enough. But before we venture in that direction, I do want to direct your attention to these pieces of artillery over here. You get a pretty good view of them from here. Just make note of where they are, because when we get over to this side of the field, you might not be able to see them quite as nicely.